So, I mean, or you can just get a shot of whiskey. But no, the hot dogs are so good.
That's great, because no matter how the food happened to be, you'd think it was awesome.
Right. And the more whiskey you drink, you're like, oh my God, Sullivan's is the best place in the world. Right. But it is really good.
That's right.
And the food there, the onion rings, the burgers, the chicken. So that's right off Route 3 at Hanover Crossing, which used to be the Hanover Mall before the Hanover Mall disappeared. I think we'll stop there because it's starting to get toward the top of the hour. It is the top of the hour.
It's WMFO, Medford. And all right, Mark, thank you so much. I can't tell you how great it was to have you back.
I'm actually not going anywhere.
Oh.
You kind of have to, gotta do a double goodbye.
Please come back sooner. And please, everybody that's listening out there, you're welcome. Please take notice of the GoFundMe that is the first comment in my Facebook post, just to help our friend Les Hurwitz.
Thank you so much, everybody. I mean, again, we're like at $46,000 in donations, which is incredible.
Incredible.
It just shows how great people are. And it's not just the money, it's the messages they send. I mean, people don't even know my father. Just incredible messages. Okay, I need to stop.
I know.
It's tough, and I wish he could hear us right now. He would be so happy.
All right, so it's Mark Hurwitz, Boston's Restaurant Talk, Boston's Hidden Restaurants, Mark Skin Radio, Tuesdays.
NACN, I'm actually on WRKO this morning, but don't listen to RKO because you're listening to Mike on the mic.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Mark. We'll see you again soon.
Definitely.
All right, it's 10:01. Brad Helene, who is currently playing bass with Nervous Eaters, is coming up next, and I figured, what could I do to play him on? What could I play? And I figured, I'm going to play a Nervous Eaters song.
Really?
Yeah, it's such a DJ
thing
to do. That's
kind of, wow.
Yeah, no, this is
high level.
There's so many great songs on this record. Their latest, it's just such a great record. And I'm going to play Superman's Hands. And right after Superman's Hands, Brad's going to be here talking to us right here.
Great.
At WMFO Medford. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
See ya.
See ya.
Tad unusual. Your mama thinks that I'm a bit delusional. I just wanna be an ordinary tree. Shooting.
It's 10:05 in the morning here at WMFO Medford. I'm Mike. Mark's still here, but he's not going to do too much. He's just kind of hanging for a few minutes before he has to go off to his next thing. But sitting across the table and smiling back at me, I've been waiting for this for a while, Brad, because we talked about this and we picked April 1st, April Fool's Day, which has no bearing at all on what we're doing today. But I'm really glad to welcome you here. I know you've been here before plenty of times, here with Skybar. And you are friends on Mark Skin Radio. I know that you're on there too. And I've seen you out and about in the club. So welcome.
Thank you.
To Saturday morning here at WMFO.
Nice to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome, for sure. You've had such a long career, and we talked on the phone about maybe you're coming back, you know, and sort of talking about your love of music in general, R&B, all the different flavors of R&B. But today we really want to just talk about you a little bit, have the audience understand where you came from, how you got to this point. So let's start with this. I noticed that you are from Boston, of course, but you were not born here. You're Connecticut, correct?
Actually, I was born outside Seattle.
Ah.
When my dad was in the Navy.
All right. So when did you get to Fairfield, Connecticut?
A long time after that. We moved there when it was in my sophomore year in high school.
Okay.
My father worked for General Telephone, Sylvania, and so he got transferred a lot. And like I said, when I was born, I'm the oldest of three, and he was in the Navy at the time,
okay.
1957.
So you were a sophomore in high school, so that's what, like 16?
Yeah, 15.
So what was your home life like? Was it a musical home? Parents were into music? What was it like?
Not my father so much, but my mother, definitely. She's a piano player and a singer.
Nice.
And, you know, we were church-going folk. You know, back we were Presbyterians, you know, Protestant.
I don't know. We're both Jewish, so it's just like Greek to us.
Yeah, whatever. Just like yeah. Jewish is Greek to me. I mean, organized religion in general is,
right.
You know, it is what it is. But
that's right.
I believe in spirituality, but, you know, it's... Anyway, it was a good place. We had, I mean, the first record that I ever made, I was 7 years old in Bloomington, Illinois, on Decca Records, because our church had 10 different choirs, depending on the age group.
Oh, wow.
And so our choir director, Irv Martin, was amazing. And my mother was the first one to, you know, probably when I was 5 or 6 years old, she said, we were singing hymns in church, and she said, sing this note. And she gave me a third above the root that she was singing. And so that was kind of my...
Learned how to harmonize.
That was my first music lesson, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So your love of music started early, but did you think that... Was that important enough, that young age, to think that, oh, I might want to, you know, be in the entertainment industry as a singer? Or did that not cross your mind?
Well, you know, probably at that point in time, I was more interested in playing with Hot Wheels and stuff.
Yeah, but were you singing when you were playing with the Hot Wheels?
Maybe. But I'll tell you what, February 4th, 1964 was the deciding point in my life where all bets were off that I was going to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, flipping burgers.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be a musician when I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. That was it. That was the date, the timeline when everything shifted. And of course, I didn't know it at the time, but in hindsight, you know, it's pretty clear to me that that was it. You know?
You won't be surprised to know that most people, and I talked to a lot of people coming through here, musicians, everybody. I mean, you know, the old proverbial 99.9%. When you ask about influences, that night comes up all the time. It changed changed everything.
I mean, you know, especially people, you know, are my age, I'll say anyway. You know, it's, I was seven then. I hadn't quite turned seven yet. I was six. And, but I knew.
Did you know it would be bass, either electric bass or acoustic bass, or did Paul McCartney have something to do with that?
Yeah, I mean, I was attracted to McCartney just because it was really clear to me, even at a young age, that I was witnessing a genius.
Yeah.
You know, observing him and what he was doing, you know, and it's still pretty amazing when you think about the guy. I mean, his gift for melody and the fact that he can play drums, piano, guitar, bass all equally well. I mean, it's just, you know, he's heaven sent. What else can you say about a guy like Paul McCartney?
He is heaven sent. When you listen to the Beatles or any other music, knowing that bass is really what interests you, do you listen? Like for me, I listen. I need to find a melody and a hook. That's just my thing. I don't really listen to lyrics until later. Do you seek out the bass line? Is that what happens with you?
Or? If I'm studying that tune or that style,
but I mean, you don't necessarily hear it and go, "Oh man, that's a great bottom on that song."
Well, of course I do, you know. Yeah, okay. But I mean, it's the song is the most important thing to me. I mean, if it's a good song, it's a good song. I was listening to the Eagles on the way over here, and for all you Eagles haters out there, I'll tell you what. They're an amazing group and super talented.
Well, their musicianship is, you know, you can't argue that.
Yeah, and their songwriting, their singing, I mean, just everything about it. Plus, they have a very natural sense of economy, which to me, that's why I think, you know, even though I was already, you know, a musician when the Ramones happened and the Clash and the Jam and the Pistols and the Buzzcocks and all those great bands that happened in the mid to late 70s, I was really attracted to the economy. Not necessarily the fact that people couldn't play their instruments. A lot of people say that because a lot of those bands could play their instruments, like the Buzzcocks, for instance. I mean, Pete Shelley wrote great songs, and the Buzzcocks could play. I mean, as a group, they had a very strong ensemble band, you know, sound. They had an understanding of what it meant to be in an ensemble.
I mean, I'll just say that you could only go so far with a band that doesn't know how to play their... I mean, the Go-Go's, they didn't know how to play their instruments and they did what they did, but for the most part, I would think if you're a band, you've got to learn how to understand what you're doing and play your instruments at some point. So it surprises me that some bands maybe really didn't have a good grasp of their musicianship.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of people just play that off, but I played on Jane Wedlin's first solo record from the Go-Go's, speaking of the Go-Go's, and I worked with her in L.A. and did that record with it that has Blue Kiss on it and everything, and she knows what she's doing.
Knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
Self-taught. I mean, she learned in the band.
Well, most people are self-taught. Paul McCartney's self-taught.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, The Edge, self-taught.
You know, and it's just, I mean, if you love music and you listen to music, you got to love it. I mean, if you don't, you can kind of tell.
Well, let's just use you as an example. I mean, you talked about being a sophomore in high school. When you graduated, you went immediately into on the road playing music.
2 weeks after I graduated, I was on the road.
Yeah, so when did the bass happen? When did you start playing bass?
Well, you know, I don't know what it's like in school now, but when we were like in second grade in Illinois, everybody got a Tonette, which was a plastic recorder with a little music book, and you learned how to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and, you know, Away in a Manger and all those great children's melodies, which I think are super important for the development of a musician because they're great melodies. I mean, even, you know, Happy Birthday, that's a great melody. Wish I wrote that song. But anyway, I started playing acoustic bass in an orchestra in sixth grade.
How large of an orchestra? You know, just a school orchestra.
Yeah, school orchestra. You know, I think there was three chairs in the bass section, so three bass players.
So it was one of those big stand-up basses?
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah.
Neat. And when did you have your Go Electric experience?
Junior high school.
Junior, and you were in like a band outside of school, or was that like a...
Yeah. We were in I had a little rock band. I think, you know, we had the typical things, like we practiced in my parents' basement, and so we knew the lick to Sunshine of Your Love and A God of the Vita, just the licks, and we would just play those over and over and over with one of those Christmas tree lights that had like four lenses in it that turned around, spun around, that you'd shine on maybe an aluminum tree or something, and we'd have that in front of us, you know, and we felt like we were really something.
A little atmosphere there.
Yeah. You know.
All right, cool. So, you know, being on the road like that right after you graduate high school is amazing. So you spent some time in top 40 bands.
I did. It was quite a learning experience. I mean, I was 18 and, you know, at that time, so we're talking 1975, every hotel had a lounge, every lounge had a band, every band played six nights a week, five sets a night, 340 dates a year. 340 nights a year. So, I mean, I you know, and it was Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder, Rufus, Average White Band.
All right, speaking of bass lines.
All the disco stuff. So, I mean, it was really an education.
So, being just out of high school, who were your bandmates? Were they friends of yours from high school?
No. I mean, in the top 40 bands?
Yeah.
No. When I, about 3 weeks before I graduated high school, I was like, my father said, so what are you going to do? I said, you know, because, I mean, he knew I wasn't going to college at that point in time. And I said, well, I'm going to be a musician. And he goes, well, what are you really going to do? I mean, what are you going to do for work? And I said, I'm going to be a musician. So I went into this, I looked in the Yellow Pages. I found this agency called Complex 4. A guy named Dick Grass ran it down in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I walked into his office. Typical agent, had his glasses hanging over his nose and smoking a cigar, and he looked up at me and he goes, what can I do for you, kid?
Yeah.
And I said, I'm looking for a gig. And he goes, you're looking for a gig? well, are you any good?
Right.
And I said, yeah, I'm pretty good. He goes, what do you play? And I said, I'm a bass player.
Yeah.
He said, all right, give me your number. So I gave him my number. I got home. About 2 hours later, the phone rang.
Yeah.
And this drummer who lived in Wethersfield, Connecticut, I was in Fairfield then, called me up and he goes, hey, I got your number from Dick Grass. I heard you're looking for a gig. You're a bass player? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, you any good? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, play me something. And I said, what do you mean, right now over the phone? He goes, yeah, play me something. So I played him the lick to keep playing that Rock and Roll by Edgar Winter off the White Trash album. And he said, all right, great, you're hired. He gave me the gig, and I met him at the Hi Ho Motel on the Mirror Parkway. Yeah, at the Mirror Parkway at like 2 a.m. We drove to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I started that night. I didn't know any of the tunes. We rehearsed all afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure I completely hacked them up. The band wasn't really that good, but
Did they have a full band at this? A full bar at this place, so that they didn't hear you, the people.
No, it was during the day. It was, you know, we were, yeah.
Day drinkers.
Yeah. So, you know, even though people might have had a few drinks in there, but nobody was really in there during the day. But yeah, so, you know, it was, I worked for three different groups for that agency over a 2-year period before I moved to Boston.
So that was 1975 to like 1977, 78.
Yep.
And at that point, you got off the road and you moved to Boston.
I did. My parents were then living in Lexington, Kentucky. My father got transferred there, so I went there for a summer, hung out with them, saw the Some Girls tour, which was pretty awesome.
Wow.
Eddie Money opened. Also saw Boston, too. They were touring their debut record. I think that was...
Wow, that record changed everything,
amazing,
too.
Amazing album. Yeah. Another album people love to hate, because it is slick, but it's a great record. I mean, really genius production. And
when you put something out that is so different from everything else that's out at that point, and that's what that was.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like the Beatles on that day in 1964.
Right.
Yeah. So you really ingrained yourself into the whole Boston scene when you got here, and Pastiche happened.
Yeah, a couple days. Well, I came to Boston because I was like, okay, it's New York or Boston. Boston got the short straw because I knew one person here, the singer in my high school band. So I moved to Boston, and within a day, I heard this great music coming from across the hall, and I knocked on their door, and I introduced myself to these two guys that were living over there, and I was like, what are you guys listening to? And they were listening to the first Boom Boom Band record with Radio Heart on it, and, looking like a bimbo and all that stuff, and the guitar player just knocked me out, and I mean, at that time, little did I know that I'd become very good friends with Billy Lusigian and work with him in the Joneses, and the first time I was in the Eaters, Billy was in the group then. So, and then within a couple of days after that, I answered an ad, and, you know, we had two great newspapers at that time, the Real Paper and the Phoenix, and there was, like, you know, a Boston band listing, there was something like 2,000 original bands in town back in those days, and they rehearsed at the Music Complex, which, you know, was down by Babbo's and Fresh Pond, which is gone now. But everybody rehearsed there. And, you know, I went down and met Mr. Kurt and Ken and Ron Marinek and Rick Martin. God bless Rick Martin. He's passed away. And it was awesome. And they hired me, and we had a nice little run there. Released a couple singles. Won the Rumble in 1980.
Played the Rumble. Won it.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy.
Oh, that's crazy. You know, so you also got to play... you mentioned the Eaters. You did a stint with them a little bit way back when as well. And you mentioned Willie Alexander and the Outlets, too.
I did, yeah.
You played with. I love the Outlets.
Yeah, Dave's a great songwriter.
Yeah, that's a great band. So already your pedigree in Boston is starting to form.
Yeah, and that was after Pastiche, I played with a band called Adventure Set, which they're still, Mark and Ken are still together and writing songs now, but I was in the first version of that group. And then we were doing a gig at Spit on Lansdowne Street, and I was with my girlfriend at the time. She was at the gig, and from the bandstand, I could see, like, who are these two guys that are, like, basically really hitting on her? And, you know, so on the break, I walked over, and I was like, what's up, fellas? This is my girlfriend. And it was Vince Ely, the drummer for the Psychedelic Furs, and Ian Taylor, who was Roy Thomas Baker's engineer. And they were in town working with a band called Ministry. And they said, hey, you know, and they were backpedaling now because they knew they were in territory that wasn't theirs. And they said, hey, you want to come down and play a couple of bass tracks on this record that we're working on? We'd like your bass playing. So I did. And I got along with Al, and he hired me. And that was
like 1981.
Yeah, 81.
After you won the Rumble with Pastiche.
Yeah, so I was back and forth between Chicago in Boston for a couple of years.
You toured with them for like 2 years.
Yeah.
Right? And that wasn't it. You also toured with Police on the Synchronicity Tour.
We were, yeah. We opened.
What was that like? Yeah.
Big venues.
Right? What is it like being in front of that many people? And do you ever get used to it?
Yeah. I never had like the stage fright thing. I mean, there's certainly some anxiety when you're going up in front of 65,000 people, gigs that size. I mean, all their gigs on that tour were like at least 20,000,
That's a huge tour.
But it was, it was cool. I mean, we opened for Culture Club at
Madness.
And Madness, yeah. So, and the band, Ministry was pretty popular. I think Mark's leaving.
No. I was just going to say, so you were in the early version of Ministry, back when they were kind of a new wave, more like the synth pop or synth rock, before they became a little heavier.
Yeah, I didn't. I was with them at the beginning of their industrial period. Like I did, the last record I did with them was Twitch, the first record on Sire. It was kind of like, I always said the version of Ministry that I was in was like Chic meets The Cure.
Mm.
It was, because it was a very heavy R&B element, During sound checks, we would do anything from, we would do La Freak or we would do Zeppelin tunes or, we'd do lots of different stuff.
Big reliance on the bass player and that kind of stuff. How much fun was that for you?
It was great.
Oh, my God.
It was great. And Al was a super talented guy, very, very talented.
Yep.
So,
And speaking of the whole Boston thing, you also got involved with Elliot Eastern. For some recording with him.
Yeah, it was a result of playing in Ministry because we worked, the Arista record was done at Synchro, which was the Car studio. And and I got to be good friends with Rick, and he hired me for an Iggy Pop session, and Elliot hired me to play in his record. And, I started to get a lot of calls. It was nice.
Mm.
It was a nice time.
Yeah, just...
It was like 83.
Making a name for yourself in the whole, that whole like bubble of professional musicians.
Yep.
Yeah, just for the uninitiated, which I am, what is it? What is it like? Do you feel a little weird working with people that are so established? Or were you always very confident? You could just go in there and say, "I'm a bass player. I can do this," and just strut your stuff and do it.
Well,
what's it like?
Sometimes I get hired by professors at Berkeley to go in and do like ensemble stuff and work with students. And when they get to ask me questions, they say like, "So, what do you blah 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 blah?" And I said, "Well, one of the most important things you got to learn how to do is navigate personalities, especially in the studio. Get takes quickly, and don't let any arrogance or other people's insecurities get in your head." Which, you don't have to be a musician to, like, actually navigate that stuff in life. I mean, that's one of the biggest things about, one of the best things about getting older is that, hopefully you learn to let people rent less space in your head.
Oh, yeah,
true. When you're younger, you don't really have an awareness around that. So, of course, being in my 20s and stuff, I was nervous. And, and especially if there was arrogance and, and I didn't really know anything about other people's insecurities or my own insecurities for that matter. So I just took it like people didn't like me if they weren't nice, if people are comfortable with themselves and they have their shit together. Can I say that?
No.
Well, okay,
you did.
Good.
It's okay.
I just did.
Yeah.
Anyway, if they have themselves together spiritually and emotionally and they like themselves, they're easy to deal with because they're not all uptight about, anything else.
Yep, and it's so true what you said. They don't know that, though, until you get older.
Right.
And then,
takes time. Takes time to learn that kind of stuff.
Bye, Mark.
See you later, Mark. Nice to meet you.
Great to meet you, Brad. I'll be listening on the way to,
wherever you're
going.
All right.
See ya.
Nice to meet you.
You take care.
Bye. All right, so Ministry, that ended, and you ended up here back in Boston.
Yep.
And you ended up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
Which you mentioned before.
Yeah, before that, it was like you said, the Outlets, the Buddy System was another band that I worked with that was out of Boston.
And Joneses got signed.
Yep. Well, that happened right on the heels of the end of my first tenure with the Eaters. Billy and I left the Eaters. And
and Steve Cataldo has been a constant the whole time, right?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Without Steve, there is no New York Nervous Eaters.
Crazy.
Amazing. Amazing talent, Steve. I mean, just,
So the Joneses, I remember that time. I mean, they played everywhere. I was interning at WBCN, so I remember, you know, all that went on. It became a staple, you know. Quite a cool band. And was that your first experience being, you know, signed to a label?
No, because Ministry was signed to Arista and Sire, and I'd put out the record with Elliot on Elektra, and yeah, I'd already had quite a bit of major label experience.
Probably never gets old though, huh, to be with a band that's on a major label.
Well, it doesn't, that doesn't really even exist anymore.
No, it was so different back then.
You know, now it's like all record deals are pretty much licensing deals, or, you know, it's a different world.
I know it. So there was some more touring and recording. You mentioned Amy Mann. You also got to tour with some greats, Monster Mike Welch.
Yeah, Mike's a great guitar player and a good friend.
Yeah, that was the Just Like It Is time.
Yeah.
Susan, is it Tedeschi or Tedeschi?
Tedeschi, yeah.
Yeah, love her. You were a part of her touring band for a couple of years.
Yeah.
That's another bunch of large shows that you got to play. One that really interests me is Room Full of Blues, man. You got to be with that outfit.
I did. Yep. 5 years.
That must have been thrilling.
Yeah, I learned a lot. You know, it's and I'll go back to playing with the Eaters in the 80s. So when the chair opened, for the bass chair opened, when I talked to Steve initially, because I didn't know him, Steve and my relationship, I mean, it goes way back, like December 8th, 1980. Does that ring a bell to you, that date?
Yeah, Mr. Lennon.
Yeah. So that night at the Bradford Hotel downtown in Boston, there was a show. Pastiche, Zion Annotation, and the Nervous Eaters. And after we finished our set, the Pats were playing, and Howard Cosell came on the air, yep. And he said, Ronald Reagan's been shot, and he got it screwed up, and then he came back, and he said, I'm sorry, it was John Lennon.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So anyway,
jeez.
And Steve and I talk about that date. We were actually rehearsing December 8th this past year, and we both looked at each other and remembered, had a moment of silence, you know, around that. But Steve said to me, so getting back to Roomful, Steve said to me in the 80s, he said, if you want to play in the Eaters, you have to play in my blues band first. Mm. I mean, Steve's a very deep guy as far as blues goes, and he gave me a cassette tape, which I still have, of mostly Chess stuff, Howlin' Wolf, awesome. Muddy Waters, Sonny Boy, Memphis Slim, And I played with this blues band, and I did okay. And I got that gig, and I got the Eaters chair. And the first time I played with Hubert Sumlin, which was Wolf's guitar player, was with Steve. I played with Hubert a few times, but before he passed away. But yeah, so getting back to Roomful. Yeah, so I played with Roomful for 5 years. So that all leading up to that. I think, you know, by the early 90s, when Mike Welch was the first person I went to Europe with, and when I was really getting serious about playing blues, because I just pretty much had it with the music industry and all of the Hollywood crap that goes around.
I suppose there's only so much you can take.
Yeah. And I was just like, you know what? I just want to play my bass and get paid. So, when I played with Roomful, that was a great experience and learned a ton. One of the records I played on was Grammy nominated, and you know.
You also played with Johnny Winter?
I did.
Yep.
I played on a record with him. Never toured with him or anything, but a record that he did on Virgin called I'm a Blues Man.
Yeah, must have been a hell of an experience as well.
Duke Robillard.
Duke Robillard is next, yeah.
12 years. 12 years I was in Duke's band.
How did you guys meet?
We met because I'd been playing a lot with the drummer, Mark Texera, who's, you know, for my money,
I know that name.
One of the best drummers in New England. I mean, he's just amazing. He's not just a drummer, he's a great musician, plays guitar, piano, just he understands a song. He's got great ears. And I was playing with him. Mike and I and Mark were playing a lot together. So he recommended me for the bass chair in Duke's band when it came available. And I went down and auditioned, and that's how we met. And we worked together for 12 years, saw the world many times over with Duke, and played on a zillion records with him. He produced a lot of records that I got to play on. Like, I worked with Madeline Perot, Maria Muldaur, Catherine Russell, Otis Clay, all because of Duke, because he was producing those sessions, and I got hired to play bass on all those records.
And there were six records that he made with Duke.
Yep.
Right?
As a leader.
Yeah.
And countless as a producer.
Yeah. Amazing. All right. Well, at 10:29 in the morning, just about 10:30, we're here with Brad Helene, who is currently playing with Nervous Eaters. So I've just been talking a little bit about his career, his long career as a bass player, both acoustic bass and electric bass. And I just want to say as well, if there's any budding musicians out there, I know that you also give lessons for the bass.
Yeah, I don't really teach anymore because I'm a student myself, and you know, I spend my time. I mean, I think it's really important if there are any budding musicians or any established musicians out there. I'm sure there's plenty. Try to keep a beginner's mind. I know that helps me, and because I'm constantly trying to improve my skill set and. Like the great jazz saxophone player Jerry Baganzi, who's a local legend in Boston here, once said to me, "Brad, we'll never learn it all in this lifetime."
Yeah, it's very true.
So
you can try, though. I mean, you may as well try some when you're here.
Well, yeah. Really, that's all we can do is do the best we can, and you know.
So we had talked a little bit about your influences, and you know, you told me the same thing that everybody says, and it's true. I mean, how do I narrow that down? There's so many, but we ended up with two, and I was really happy with the two. We already touched on one of them, the Beatles, and the other one was the Stones. And the songs that you picked, you had said that it's all about the songs for you. You know, you just love the songs. And these two songs could be on, remember that show Name That Tune?
Yeah.
Play 2 seconds of a song.
Right.
Yeah, you could do that with these two songs.
Most people would probably get know them, you know.
Ubiquitous is what they are.
Yeah.
Right? In the music world. So, the Beatles, was it their first release? The first major release, I Want to Hold Your Hand?
No. Well, it was one of them. It was one of them. By the time they came to the States, it was probably the song that really cracked them over here. But they'd already released She Loves You and Please Please Me and... you know, but getting back to songs that, for me, I mean, you know, be different for you, Mike, could be different for everybody, but everybody has songs for them that hold a special place in their hearts because what was happening in their lives at the time that those songs were on the air and that you started to have a relationship with a certain song, it's all about what was going on in your life that triggers that. You know, what might mean something special to me is not going to necessarily mean something special for you. Sometimes, you know, we do meet, though, on songs, you know, people.
Yeah, I mean, I say it all the time. Music's very subjective.
Yeah.
However, if you're a music lover, and I say this all the time, too, I mean, I can't imagine a day going by that I don't listen to something. I mean, I have to have something going on. So let me just sort of expand on what you were saying. Before we spin these two tracks by the Beatles and the Stones, talk about how could you, who's been playing music for most of your life, how do you whittle it down to, for example, I Want to Hold Your Hand? What is it about that song?
It's just the sound of it. The sound of the guitars, first of all, is just, you know, the hand claps that are in it, the vocals, just everything about it. But I think more than anything, it's just the sound of the guitars in that song that just, I mean... I'll just whittle it down to the car radio. When I heard those songs on a car radio, was just like, you know, songs used to be, I remember back in the day, you know, we would go out in the car and listen to mixes.
Willie Alexander captured that.
Yeah. You know, it's just the way they sound on the car radio. And, you know, when I heard all that stuff from the 60s on my parents' car radio, you know, Motown being one of the biggest things, all the Motown, great Motown stuff. But, you know, that's what it is.
And I can understand now with the second choice that you made by the Stones, Jumpin' Jack Flash. And you were very specific, the original studio version of that. Same kind of feeling about that song, car radio? Or?
Yeah. And just, you know, I think it might have been one of the first tunes where Charlie Watts, every time he hit the snare drum, like if he's playing eighth notes on the hi-hat, he lifted the stick up and didn't play the eighth note on the hi-hat when he was hitting the snare on beats 2 and 4. So it was one of the first tunes that he did that, which is now like a thing. Like in the studio, a lot of times producers or musicians will say to the drummer, "Hey, do that Charlie thing on this tune." And also there's a shaker playing eighth notes in that song, which was one of the first tunes to do that, which AC/DC incorporated into their career very nicely. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, just... those type of things as a musician. But once again, it just comes down to the sound of that song is just special.
You know, I get to talk to a lot of people doing this, and the same thing kind of happens, and it's happening right now with you. Talking about the music that you love, you just light up. It's you. It's everything. So let's hear those songs, everybody. Let's hear the Beatles. Let's hear the Stones, and we'll come back and talk about the Eaters. How's that sound?
Sound good.
All right. It's WMFO.
It's
10:40 in the morning. Yeah, we're just sitting here listening to those two songs we heard. I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles and Jumba Jack Flash from the Stones. And there's a, you know, we're just sitting here head bobbing because that, what else are you going to do? That stuff is gold.
Absolute diamonds.
It is. Yeah. Yeah, precious is really the way it is. So let's talk Eaters.
Yeah, sure.
So you had mentioned you'd been in the Eaters for a stint some years ago, but the current lineup has been around since 2020? Did you form during the pandemic?
Yeah, yeah. David and I and Steve started off, you know, and yeah, we got together. I gave Duke Robillard my notice in February of 2020. Yeah, and then we you know, Steve called me up like 2 days later and he said, hey, my bass player left, you know anybody that's looking for a gig? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I'm open.
There you go.
And I just figured, you know, initially I was just like, any chance to go down and play Last Chance, Girl Next Door, Loretta, Just Head, I mean, I love all those tunes. And you know, and then he started playing me the new stuff and I was like, wow, this is really good. So we played one gig in March at the Square Root in Roslindale, and then everything shut down.
Yeah, sure it did.
And we rehearsed for a little while, and then we took a break just because everybody was trying to be careful. And we got back together, we did a demo that year, later in the fall of that year, of three tunes, and it came out really good. And we sent it to a friend of ours who used to be the head of Sony Legacy that we all had a long relationship with, Steve Berkowitz. And because he was like the road manager for Willie Alexander and the Boom Boom Band when David was in the band. He knew Steve back from the days when Rick got them a deal with Elektra. And he knew me from when I was in ministry because he worked for Lookout Management then. He was the East Coast rep and managing the cars. And he paid me every week, so I got to know him very well.
There you go.
And he worked with Adam Sherman in the Souls. So the current lineup of the Eaters is obviously Steve Cataldo, David McLean, Adam Sherman, and myself.
Mm-hmm. And Adam completed the picture.
He did. Yep.
You needed a rhythm guitarist and a background vocalist.
And another person that can sing, you know. So Adam and I, you know, we have a nice singing relationship together. I mean, we have a good blend to do harmonies behind Steve, so it works out pretty good.
Yeah, he's another one that's been around here forever. He's a New Yorker originally. Yeah. I don't hold it against him. But yeah, he's been a great addition to the band. So this current lineup, you guys released your latest Monsters. Is it Monsters and Angels or Monsters Plus Angels?
Monsters and Angels, yeah.
Monsters and Angels. It's, you know, you guys have done your part. I mean, what a great record.
Thank you.
I mean, honestly, you got to be so proud of it. We touched on that record companies aren't the same. Now, you've got a great record company, you know, Stevie Van Zandt's record company, Wicked Cool. That's all great, but it's not like it was. And they're trying. I mean, they've got Sirius, and they're playing you like crazy, and we're playing you, and but it's not like it was.
It's rock and roll is a very challenging game these days.
Yeah, frustrating.
Yeah.
But love the record. So you're welcome. I want to talk about some of these songs that are on here. And when we talked about it, I was like, so what do you want me to play? You know, and you said, let's play some of the more obscure ones. One of which I've played before, A Thousand Ships. Now, is Steve he's the guy that writes all the stuff?
Yeah, he wrote all the songs on this record. Yeah.
Okay. So lyrics, melody, everything.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
and does he have it? He directs you guys how he hears it in your head.
Well, he usually makes a demo because he's really good. He's a good drummer. I mean, not that he physically plays drums, but he's good at programming drum parts, and he hears everything. And he's a very good bass player, and obviously a killer guitar player and stuff. So he makes home demos. He gives them to us, and he trusts us because, you know, being in a band, one of the most important things is trust, just like any relationship.
Yeah.
Whether it's a marriage or a band or a friend or whatever, trust is it. And he trusts us that we will retain the parts that are important to the tune, and then he gives us a lot of freedom to incorporate our own ideas into the songs.
Very cool. And the other track I haven't played before, Tear Me Up. Just before we spin, though, is there anything in particular you want to talk about either one of those two, or shall we just hear them?
Well, I always, when I first heard those songs, I always thought they had, you know, because we're huge Bowie fans, and I always found them to be, you know, have somewhat kind of a Bowie influence. And actually, A Thousand Ships is about David Bowie.
Okay.
Margaret Mary Jones, that was the name of his, that was David's mother's name, and that's his real last name, Jones, everybody knows that. So, yeah, and it's, you know, that song in particular kind of incorporates a lot of different things, you know, the 12 string stuff that we love, like from the Byrds and Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and then there's the bass line's kind of R&B influenced, you know, and you know,
that's just screaming Bradleen, you know. And Tear Me Up, what's that about? It any comments about that?
It's kind of about the government. No, I'll leave it up to your you know,
share no more
without actually, you know, saying too much about that.
All right, let's start with A Thousand Ships, and we'll segue beautifully into Tear Me Up, and we'll be back with Bradleen. WNO.
Thank you.
WMFO Medford, 10:53 in the morning. Mike, Brad Helene from Nervous Eaters is here, and we just heard a couple of really great tracks from their latest called Monsters and Angels. That was 1,000 Chips segueing into Tear Me Up, and we got time for one more, but before that, great news. You guys have 15 new songs.
We do.
And you're going to go in the studio April...
Yeah, we're starting tracking April 16th.
Wow.
So... Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Is it too early to? We're looking forward to. Is it too early to know when this is slated for release? Or
what's going to happen? We've got a pretty good marketing plan with Wicked Cool, so the record and CD is not going to come out till 2024. Mostly because we had to release the CD and vinyl separately on this last release because sourcing vinyl is very time consuming. Yeah. Now it takes about 9 months, so that's why we want to have the record delivered, mixed and mastered by July, which will allow us for a late winter, early spring release, 2024. But the good news is...
Singles before that?
There will be two physical singles with B-sides that won't be on the record.
Oh.
And there's going to be three digital tracks that won't be on anything that are going to be released first. That
just live in the ether and the digital.
Just so we can have a marketing campaign.
That's
so
great.
Just so we can keep the fire...
Out of sight, out of mind is not what you want.
Try to keep the fire hot, you know what I mean? And you know, because let's face it, the market is inundated with product right now. There's so much. Everybody's making records, and it's you know, which is good. That's good, but it still makes it more challenging for a band to stay, you know, in the mix of getting airplay and, you know.
Well, we're doing our part to keep Monsters and Angels alive.
We appreciate that,
and we have time for one more track. This is one of my favorites, Chad. Mm. It's about Steve Cataldo's.
It's an ex-girlfriend he knew. Ex-girlfriend, yep.
Yeah?
Yep.
And anything in particular about the lyrics or the song before we spin it?
I mean, you know. It's
a great song.
Yeah, any great songwriter, it's all about universal interpretation. So it could be about your girlfriend, Mike. You know what I mean? Or mine.
It is, yeah. I
or
get
Jane's
that.
Boyfriend.
I get
or
that.
Or girlfriend, or whatever.
I get that.
Exactly.
All right, 10:56 in the morning.
I caught it before you did, Jane.
Let's spin Chad at WMFO. Great song, everybody.
Oh!
Chad, where did you go? It's about 11 a.m. right here at WMFO in Medford. I'm Mike. I want to thank Brad Helene so much. We'll do this again. We got so much more to talk about. Just, you know, the love of music will drive us.
Excellent. Well, thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. And we can't wait. Nervous Eaters are going to be recording. You're in the studio again April 16th.